From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, Boots on the Ground, Stories from the War in Iraq, a special series from To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, Esprit de Corps. When it comes down to it, for many soldiers and Marines, war is not about the mission. War is not about the enemy. It's not about patriotism. War is about the man to the left and right of you, about your buddy.
Combat's just kind of something that happens on the battlefield. But for me, you know, the experiences, you know, the fellowship with the other guys, you know, that was what was defining my life, not, you know, the bullets or the weapons.
Sergeant First Class Toby Nunn.
When I went with the strikers to Iraq, we had a soldier, Sergeant Jake Demand. Great guy, father of two of his own boys and then a little girl. He unfortunately made the ultimate sacrifice over there. And I couldn't help but think about these two little boys and this little girl that will never really know what their father experienced over there. And I don't mean the harshness. I mean the sweetness, the how he cared for his guys and was always good for a laugh and a great broiled salmon. Who's going to tell them that not only could their dad tie a mean knot, you know, that he cared for people in a way that not many people ever have, especially with what it took for him to leave this earth for some of us to stay. Wait, we just go a second here real quick. I haven't talked about that very often, so. Guy took 18 rounds on the ramp of a striker. Bled out on the scene so everybody else could get on the striker. Not many people do stuff like that. 90 seconds, 8 magazines. He's a real hero. Not many people know that, you know? He's just a number to a lot of people.
Sergeant First Class Toby Nunn. He's the epitome of the idea of esprit de corps. He served 2 tours of duty in Iraq. Sergeant Nunn cared deeply about the mental and physical health of the men he led as they experienced the violence, destruction, and stress of heavy combat. After living 24/7 with your finger on the trigger and nostrils flared, Nunn says, it's very hard to adjust back to civilian life. That's why he's still taking care of his men today, even when they're home. Steve Paulson asked Nunn about his men.
You were the subject of a documentary that was made about your squad. It was called Bad Voodoo's War. And one of the things that was very clear about that was that you felt a personal responsibility to care for the guys in your squad. I mean, you were going to do everything you could to bring them back alive and hopefully in one piece. Do you still feel that sense of responsibility now that you're home?
Absolutely. Any soldier that I've had the honor to lead or be around is, you know, someone very dear and special to me. Even the guys that didn't like me and I didn't like, you know, they're still very, very dear to me. And the awesome responsibility of human life weighs heavy. And when a mom charges you with the health and welfare of her son or a wife or a child, depends on you to make sure that their dad makes it back all right. You can't take that lightly. And I think anyone that just laughs at it off or shrugs it off is a terrible leadership failure. You know, I care about these guys still. You know, I'm leaving tomorrow to go out and, you know, yank the head out of one of my guys' butts because, you know, he's been a knucklehead since he's been back. Because, you know, it's tough on these young guys. They spend a lot of time overseas living 10 seconds at a time. They don't think that they have to plan for the future. And when you go through life living it 10 seconds at a time, you don't save your money, you don't, you know, plan your future, you don't react to things in a timely manner, and you find yourself in a lot of trouble that, you know, you typically won't find because your entire adult life's been spent dealing with survival, physical survival. And, you know, when you look at Maslow's hierarchy, it's tough to believe that, you know, a large portion of our youth are dealing on the lowest level, and that's just mainly subsistence.
Sergeant First Class Toby Nunn served 2 tours of duty in Iraq. Steve Paulson spoke with him. Nunn currently works for the nonprofit group Soldiers Angels, which supports veterans and deployed military personnel and their families, from their Adopt a Soldier program to coordinating the making of homemade quilts for wounded veterans. Their motto? May no soldier go unloved. May no soldier walk alone. May no soldier be forgotten until they all come home. Tyler Boudreaux's a 12-year veteran of the Marine Corps. In 2004, he was deployed to Iraq for a tour of duty in an infantry battalion. Following that deployment, Boudreaux became the commanding officer of a rifle company. While preparing to return to Iraq, he resigned his commission because of reservations over the legitimacy of the war. He writes about his experiences in his book Packing Inferno, The Unmaking of a Marine. Anne Strainchamps asked Boudreaux if he was against the war from the start.
Well, there was some ambiguous feelings about it, for sure. I wasn't completely sold on the invasion, but I had been in the Marine Corps for 10 years at that point, and there was a part of me that very much wanted to go to war, and all I needed was some sort of justification. And when they sort of shifted gears, you know, away from the weapons of mass destruction and to a liberation of Iraqi people and helping Iraqi people, that to me was satisfactory. So I said, well, okay, in this case, I'll go and I'll try to help. And this way here, I can also, you know, perhaps get into a few fights, and this will, you know, sort of serve that craving that I've had to get into combat.
At least at the beginning, there was actually some exhilaration, some pleasure in some of the firefights. I mean, you write about one of the first big firefights you were in. There's a story you tell about Lutafia.
That's right. Lutafia was a town south of our base, and it was very hostile towards American forces. And whenever we had forces down there, they were sure to get hit in one way or the other, whether by sniper fire, an RPG, or an IED, which is these roadside bombs. And we had sort of this growing and escalating series of battles. And so on, I think it was the second or third day of this escalation, I was traveling down with, you know, a detachment of the battalion down this road called Route Jackson. It was sort of the main road from Mamadia, which was north, to Lutafia, south. And there was a pretty significant ambush in place, and they were on both sides of the road, and there was just a lot of fire, a heavy volume of fire and RPGs and whatnot. And so we, you know, sort of went through that. And
you write about it that, you know, you all emerged unscathed, and at the end of it, you sound joyful, like you guys are dancing around and hugging each other and really excited.
Yeah, well, absolutely. So this is what I'm talking about with, you know, a combination of the adrenaline of having survived, first of all, with, you know, you almost get sort of a sport feeling to it. And the fact that nobody got killed really kind of, you know, made it almost, you know, perpetuated the fantasy of war being not that bad in the moment.
So contrast that to, you know, fast forward a few years, and there's a chapter you write called, I think it's called One Death Too Many.
Mm.
By then, you had a totally different take on death and killing. Do you want to tell me about the One Death Too Many?
Well, the thing that I did during my deployment was gather trends. This is what we as officers are sort of trained to do, is to watch for trends and not make, you know, rash decisions on one or two incidents. And so I had my doubts about certain elements of the war, and, you know, but I wanted to give it a fair shake, if you will. And I, you know, I watched as the operations unfolded, and I always kept in the back of my mind the mission at hand, which was to help Iraqi people and to befriend Iraqi people. This was sort of a no uncertain terms kind of mission statement. There was very little ambiguity about that. And where it became ambiguous was, how do we go about helping the Iraqi people? Because we can't tell the difference between those who are trying to hurt us and those who need to be helped. And one of the problems we had on a routine basis was this Route Jackson, which was always littered with these IEDs, like I said, the roadside bombs. And we couldn't figure out what to do about it. Every time we drove down the road, a bomb went off. And, of course, the way they get the bombs on the side of the road is they dig a hole and they put a bomb inside and then they cover it back up again. So what happened was that anybody carrying a shovel became labeled a threat and was open to be shot. So there was many occasions, and one in particular that I remember, but this was sort of a frequent occasion where snipers were out on the ground and they were trying to find these guys digging holes in the ground for IEDs, and they would call me up and they'd say, you know, we've got this guy on the side of the road with a shovel, and they would request permission to engage this individual, meaning they wanted to shoot him. And, you know, they were say, you know, 200, 300 meters away from this individual with a shovel on the side of the road. And it seemed like a very unambiguous situation, except for the fact that in Iraq, many people farm at night because of the heat and because of the electrical situation. A lot of the irrigation systems were only working at night. And we knew this after a while. But the problem is that every time you asked an Iraqi, you know, whether he was a farmer or a terrorist, they would always say they were a farmer. And it got to be where we would get frustrated and started to assume that everybody we spoke to was lying. And then after a while, we just stopped asking and we would just open fire on anybody with a shovel. And of course, after the fact, I started to think about that and said, well, gee, you know, I don't think that it's possible to guess right 100% of the time, which means that I had to have guessed wrong some of those times, at least once. And that means that I approved and authorized somebody, you know, a farmer getting shot, and I was not happy about that.
So you had been trained by the Marines to admire the killer inside you, you know, to find the killer inside you and then to feel proud of him. Eventually, it sounds like you became sickened by the killer inside you.
Well, yeah, that's right. They do want you to be proud of and sort of harness that killer inside you. It's true, but it's attached to a noble cause. It's always attached to a noble cause. And as long as you have that noble cause, fighting for freedom, democracy, the security of our nation, those sorts of things, defending the Constitution, then it makes more sense. It's when the mission becomes unclear or maybe, you know, you're not sure that the mission is quite just. That's when all that killing comes to the forefront and you really start to notice how terrible it is.
Mm. So you served in the Marine Corps for more than 12 years, and then after serving 1 year in Iraq, you wound up resigning your commission.
Mm.
Why?
I came to a point where I just no longer felt like we were fulfilling the mission that we'd gone to do. And as a commander, which I was a rifle company commander, that's not acceptable. You have to love your mission more than you love your Marines or your soldiers. And what I mean is that you have to be willing to sacrifice the lives of your men for the mission. You know, if there's a road that has to be traveled, then you've got to send those Marines down the road. If there's a hill that's got to be taken or a beachhead that's got to be taken or whatever the objective is, you know that it's going to cost lives. And so, in other words, you must love that mission more than you love your Marines. And there came to be a point where the reverse was true, where I loved my Marines more than the mission, and so I deemed myself ineligible to command any further and had to resign.
Is there any part of you that feels guilty, as though you betrayed your fellow Marines? I mean, a big part of the Marines' sort of raison d'etre is all about loyalty to mm-hmm. each other.
I think that it would have been, in a way, disloyal to stay on and fake it, because by faking it, I could very well have cost lives that otherwise would not have been lost by being unsure or by hesitation or whatever might have unfolded had I gone to Iraq being unsure.
Do you still believe in war?
I don't rule out armed conflict because I don't have a crystal ball. I don't know what's going to happen in the future. But I am at the same time suspicious of many of the operations that the United States has initiated in the past and present.
Is there any part of you also that still misses war?
No. No, not at all.
Tyler Boudreau, talking with Anne Strainchamps. Boudreau's the author of Packing Inferno, The Unmaking of a Marine. Sometimes esprit de corps takes a somber form. John Robleski Sr. learned this all too well on April 6, 2004. It was the day he found out that his son, Marine Second Lieutenant John Robleski Jr., or JT as his family and friends called him, had been killed in our Ramadi. Anne Strainchamp spoke with John Robleski Sr. about the knock at the door that all Marine families dread.
It was a knock that, to this day, I can hear it. It had such a distinct sound, you know, and I opened the door, and I saw two uniformed Marines and a uniformed chaplain standing there, and I knew what they were going to tell me, and I just kept saying to them, not my JT. Please, not my JT. And they asked if they could come in, and we let them in. And they asked, you know, are you Mr. Robleski? By that time, my wife came into the living room, and my other three sons came in, and my sister was standing right in the kitchen with her daughter. And that's when he said that, you know, we regret to inform you that your son died from wounds that he had received.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah, it's just such a, you know, a terrible time, obviously.
Yeah. I imagine that the next few days were pretty much a blur for you, but do you remember when you first began to think about actually wanting to go to Iraq yourself to see where JT had been killed?
Yes. Actually, it was the next day, and I said to my family, I said, I have to get to Iraq. I said, there's one thing that I need to do is I need to go there and see and feel and smell and taste, you know, the things that my son, you know, experienced. And you're so much a part of their life, you know, when they're growing up and all the time and doing everything you can to be at every possible event. You just want to share in that part of it too, so.
And I kind of hear you saying also that for you, that was part of being a dad, that if your son had to die, you wanted to almost hold his hand the whole way through.
Yeah, it was, it was, and, you know, going to Iraq was very emotional, and I know a lot of people say this, but it's so true, I could feel his presence. It was almost like, you know, him saying, Dad, thank you. And I just felt that he really appreciated, you know, what I was trying to do.
Will you tell me something about what it was like when you actually got to Ramadi? It was your second trip, because you couldn't get there on the first trip. Did you actually finally get to the place where you could stand and touch the dirt right where, pretty close to where you think your son was hit?
Yes, I got to the exact spot. And it was such an eerie feeling for me. I was just so anxious at this point. I remember my heart and just pounding out of my chest. There's about 25 Marines, I guess, you know, and they all got out and secured the area. So we got out, and then now I see in front of me a Marine with a handheld GPS, and the Marine puts the GPS by me, and he says to me, okay, you know, take two steps to the right, okay, just step back, and he goes, okay, you're there. And that was it. I was standing right on the spot, you know, where my son was shot. In that particular battle, on that particular day, along with my son, 10 other Marines fell, and also one Navy corpsman. And I had the names of all of those, you know, Marines and a Navy corpsman, and I read them aloud. The last name, obviously, was my son. And when I was done, the Marines yelled out, "Hoorah!" And I'll never forget that. I mean, it echoed throughout this alleyway. And then I looked around, and, you know, I could see Marines crying. And that really gets to you, you know, these Marines, they're so tough, and they're such great war fighters, and here they are, you know, so touched, but that's the Marine Corps. You know, that's what the Marine Corps is all about, is that they're all brothers, you know, and it was so evident on that day that all these other 25 Marines, I really felt that they felt what I felt.
John Robleski Sr., talking about his son, Marine Second Lieutenant John J.T. Robleski Jr. J.T. was killed in Ramadi on April 6th, 2004. And Strange Shimps spoke with his father. For To the Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, Esprit de Corps is part of our special series, Boots on the Ground, Stories from the War in Iraq, brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Want to get to know a U.S. soldier? Want to know what inspires a Marine? Try listening to their iPods.
Let the bodies hit the floor. Let the bodies hit the floor. Let the bodies hit the floor. Let the bodies hit the floor.
You're listening to Drowning Pool. The band, along with other heavy metal groups like Metallica and Slayer and the hardcore rap of Eminem and Little John, can be found on most GI's MP3 players. Jonathan Pieslak calls it the soundtrack to war. He's the author of Sound Targets, American Soldiers and the Music in the Iraq War. He says the music has come to mean a lot to U.S. soldiers deployed in Iraq.
Music will operate typically as an inspiration for combat. And occasionally, when they actually are in their Strikers, their tanks, their Bradleys, you know, these types of vehicles, because what you can do is take either an MP3 player or a portable laptop and hook it up within the communication systems of tanks. And so what some of these guys did, particularly during the initial invasion in 2003, is they would hook their portable CD players up and have music going within the communication systems of their tanks, within their helmets, as they were literally, you know, rolling down the street to Baghdad.
And I'm curious about that. What kind of music? Can you give me an example of what they might do with the music before they go out?
Oh, yeah. I mean, for example, they may either listen individually or as a group to groups like Slayer, Metallica, Drowning Pool's Bodies was a big one. Any of those types of sort of really hardcore heavy metal. Another genre that's very popular is gangster rap. So Eminem was big. Lil Jon was big. Any of those guys, DMX, you know, some of these other gangster rappers. A lot of these people were very popular. And in fact, soldiers would adopt specific anthems or songs that would function as their anthem during specific phases. So, for instance, one sergeant was describing to me that Metallica was big when they first started. So, like, they would listen to Metallica's One, and that would be sort of their initial song that they all would have as an anthem. And then when they got to Fallujah, they changed it up, and they would use Eminem's Go to Sleep.
War is so ugly and disgusting, and it's very inhuman. It's an inhuman thing. It's unnatural for people to kill people. It's something that no one should ever have to do. Unfortunately, someone does. And we happen to be that someone sometimes. And so listening to music would artificially make you aggressive when you needed to be aggressive. If you knew you were going out and you were going to get shot at, you know, you didn't want to go out there thinking everything's hunky-dory. And, you know, you had to go out there with an aggressive mindset, hoping that you wouldn't have to use that aggression. Finally, you have to kind of get yourself into that mentality that, you know what, I'm going to have to shoot at someone today, so might as well get pumped up for it. So that Eminem song, Go to Sleep, when we got to Fallujah, was kind of our anthem. And before every mission, we'd blare that, you know, and we'd all kind of, you know, scream the lyrics out. And it's a very negative song. And I'm almost even embarrassed to say it was our theme song, but hey, that's what happens in war. You've got to become inhuman to do inhuman things.
So go to sleep. Die, motherfucker.
curious. The way you describe it, it sounds as though this is all internal to the vehicle.
Yes.
This is to goose them up, to ramp them up for the combat that they're going to get into. This isn't like the scene from a movie where there's a speaker on the top of the tank that's blaring out music.
Right. Yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, there's a famous scene from Apocalypse Now in which Wagner's Ride is played from a helicopter right before an attack. In the majority of cases, it's played internally. But interestingly enough, there was one tank crew that played that music exactly like the scene on the outside of their tank.
The Ride of the Valkyries blaring absolutely. Out from the tank?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah.
Wow. Where were they?
They were on the road to Baghdad. What they did is they were on what's called a thunder run. And a thunder run is a term from the Vietnam era that describes when a group of vehicles would fight very aggressively into an area and they would actually then pull back out. It was sort of a show of force, kind of like saying to the enemy, okay, we're going to fight very strongly into your home and then we're just going to pull out just to show you that we can do it. And during one of these thunder runs into Baghdad, the guys actually did, in fact, play Wagner's Ride on the outside, very much like the scene from the movie.
So we went in, and it was just heavy fighting. I mean, RPGs left and right. It was, we lost, I think, three guys that first, the first thunder run we did. I mean, there were just Iraqi bodies just thrown on the side of the road, army, Saddam Hussein, you know, people shooting at us, trying to drive up car bombs on us. And it was literally like a gauntlet that we were driving through.
Are they allowed to do that? I mean, can they modify their vehicles? The brass gives them permission to do this?
Higher up on the chain of command, they probably would say that they're not supposed to. And, you know, I think that there have been lots of concerns about whether, you know, they're able to hear properly enough when they're listening to music, you know, in their vehicles as they're out on raids or missions. But it seems to me to be something that if the tank commander or the local level chain of command feels that this is okay, then it's all right.
So, you know, what's bothering me in the back of my mind, I have to admit, is you talk about the way they ramp themselves up. They listen to this music. They get all sort of goosed up for it. And it is almost as though when they go out and they're blaring this music, whether it's in their headphones or on the speakers, it's almost like they're inside a video game. Doesn't that take some of the reality of what they're doing away?
I think it does. I mean, I think we have to watch out with drawing too much of a parallel to video games. I think the first thing is that across the board, at least with the soldiers that I interviewed, all of them said that the music and everything stops when you actually engage in combat. And it was funny because I asked them, you know, does the music continue to roll when you get in a firefight? And they said, yeah, the music's there, but it's not in their ears. And for some reason, it just tunes out. And then many of them, when I followed up and talked about the video game analogy, said that war is very unlike a video game. And many of them said, you know, I had this perspective going in that, you know, hey, when you actually shoot someone that they fall and they die, and that's not what happens. And so I think for some of them, they kind of had an awakening over there that what truly happens in war is not what we see portrayed in video games, not what we see portrayed on television or the movies, that it's a very different thing.
Wow. So it's not, I mean, that sort of changes that whole image, doesn't it? It's not them sitting there with Metallica blaring in the background while they play a first-person shooter.
Right. Absolutely. And if they're going out and there's the possibility that someone's going to shoot at them, they need to put themselves in that type of psychological state that they're able to respond. And I think that the music, In some cases, again, you know, I think for some guys it may just sort of be a, yeah, I'm ready to play soldier today. But for other guys, you know, I think that there really is a deep personal relationship going on with that music, and it puts them in a mental state where they're able to do what they need to do. Interestingly enough, some guys have talked about how now that they're back stateside, they can't listen to that music anymore. They don't want to listen to those songs because it puts them in a place where they don't want to be.
Right about when we're about to go out on a raid or a mission or something, I'd listen to Slayer and stuff to get all, you know, into it and stuff. And, you know, it's kind of a surreal experience listening to Slayer out there, you know. It's kind of like, it's I don't know, I can't think of a, I don't know, it's
the explosions and the machine guns, like in the shooting that's going on, that's the music, you know. And it's kind of like listening to Slayer, you know, it's bada bada, you know, like that sort of shit, you know. I mean, listening to a 240 fire off rounds or a tow missile hit something, I mean, that's music to your ears.
Is this something you think the military could research, could take advantage of? I mean, can you see MP3 players being distributed with preset playlists in them?
I don't know about preset playlists, but I could certainly see an MP3 player becoming, you know, part of the standard military equipment issues. You know, one of the guys told me that he thought that the military ought to issue an MP3 player to every soldier, and that, you know, along with your M16, you should get a, you know, an iPod. So, I mean, that's, and I think what that shows is that just how strongly he felt music was an important role in his life, that it was just as important as his weapon. I don't know if they'll develop official playlists, but I think that, it plays a very important role in morale and in people's just psychological conditions while at war. So I think it just really speaks to the power that music can have on the human condition.
Jonathan Pieslak is the author of Sound Targets, American Soldiers and the Music in the Iraq War.
One time in Christmas, we were Samara, and one of the guys ordered Chipmunk's Christmas CD, where it's like Alvin Simon Theodore singing Christmas carols. And he put that in the CD player in the vehicle, and I couldn't take it. I like turned that off. I can't stand that because we'd be listening to it for hours and hours. And he got a big kick out of it, like so did the guy that was in the CC thing, you know, around Iraq listening to Chipmunk's Christmas. But like, yeah, you know, you're screwed if you don't like what the point is. Kind of.
I was a hard worker who loved her country and her service. This is not what I deserve. But, like so many other females in the military, I put up with it for the good of my family, my beliefs, my country. After my first deployment, I decided that constant harassment was part of being female in the military. So I made the decision not to tell anyone about my problems. Excuse my language, but I decided to be a bitch.
Those are the words of Air Force Sergeant Marty Ribeiro. From Helen Benedict's book, The Lonely Soldier, The Private War of Women Serving in Iraq, is a little-known fact that more than 160,000 women have served in Iraq. Roughly one of every 10 American soldiers in Iraq is female. Helen Benedict says these female soldiers too often find themselves victims of harassment and sexual abuse from the guys on their own side. She told Anne Strainchamps that many end up in virtual isolation among the men they serve with.
They're fighting a double war. They're fighting the same war that men are in Iraq and Afghanistan, but they're also fighting, if that's the right word, but they're also defending themselves in a war against them from their own comrades.
Mm-hmm. As one of the women soldiers you interviewed puts it at one point, she says she carried a knife not for the enemy but for the guys on her own side. How common is that experience?
Oh, boy, when she told me that and I first wrote it up in my earliest article about this subject, I got floods of letters from other women who'd served in Iraq and elsewhere saying, oh, that was my experience too. I carried a knife for the men on my own side. I heard that a lot. I don't want to say that this is an experience for every single woman because that would be exaggerating. But the point is it's way too common. And it's a tragedy when a person goes to war and has to deal with all the stress of combat and can't even trust their brothers and sisters at arms. It's camaraderie that holds soldiers together.
Hello, I'm Marty Ribeiro. I am 27 and third generation Air Force. My grandfather and father were Air Force officers, and all my life I wanted to be like them. I joined the Air Force Reserves after high school, and I put myself through college during my enlistment.
I got married, too, and had a baby girl. My daughter was only 2 years old when I was deployed. That was March 2003, right as the U.S. was going into war with Iraq. I was on active duty for a little over 8 years in the Air Force. I was a public affairs specialist. That means a combat correspondent and photographer. I loved my job, for the most part. But from my time at boot camp till the day I got out, I was harassed all the time. People called me Air Force Barbie. I couldn't go anywhere without being watched by a million eyes. I had a senior non-commissioned officer constantly quiz me about my sex life, show up at my barracks at odd hours of the night, and ask personal questions that no supervisor should ever have the right to ask. I had a colonel sexually harass me in ways that I am too embarrassed to explain. These are people who had complete control over my life. When I worked, when I ate, when I slept, when I could talk or not talk, rest or not rest. These are people I was supposed to obey no matter what. One time, my sergeant sat down with me in the chow hall and said, "I feel like I'm in a fishbowl the way all these men's eyes are boring into your back." I told him, "Yeah, that's what my life is like."
I suppose civilians might wonder, how easy can it be to rape a woman who's a soldier who's been trained to fight? And, you know, they're on a base, they're surrounded by other soldiers, and they are themselves carrying weapons. When and how do most of the sexual assaults happen?
A lot of them happen when the women are either isolated and easily overpowered, either because they're in the latrines or the showers. I hear about a lot of rapes in showers. Overpowering people when they're asleep, you know, catching them in moments of vulnerability. That's when it happens.
A few months into my deployment, I was directed to pull night guard duty. After a few hours, I put my weapon and my radio in the guard shack, and I walked 20 feet to the closest smoke deck. You don't ever leave your weapon anywhere when you're in a combat zone. I had a momentary lapse. I thought I'd be okay 20 feet from my weapon. I was wrong. I had just taken a few drags of my cigarette when somebody grabbed me in a chokehold and dragged me behind some power generators. All I could see was a man much larger than me wearing a U.S. Armed Forces uniform. I struggled with all my strength to get free while he dragged me to this spot. I tried my hardest to fight him off, and I got a few good kicks in, but it wasn't enough. He finished his deed and left. I waited until my shift was over, and I did what every Law and Order episode tells you to do. Don't take a shower, and go immediately to the authorities. I thought they would listen to me, but I was wrong. They told me that if I filed a claim that I had been raped, I'd also be charged with dereliction of duty for leaving my weapon unattended in a combat zone. That could get me court-martialed. That could end my career. So I shut up, and I didn't say anything to anyone.
I don't understand why, with that military emphasis on esprit de corps, you know, leave no soldier behind, why doesn't that extend to women soldiers? I mean, why isn't it that sexually assaulting or harassing a member of your own team is viewed the same way as shooting them?
Well, it certainly should be. And among some commanders and sergeants, it is. And when they have that attitude, it really makes a big difference. I've read studies showing this, and I've also heard it anecdotally from soldiers who said, my commander really did respect women and really would not tolerate anything else from the rest of us and from the men, and it really made a difference. But the trouble is that the military is still male-dominated, it's still old-fashioned, it's still full of men who don't believe that women should be soldiers, that women may be even putting them in danger, which isn't true. And all of this is a way of trying to drum them out. It's a way of showing resentment and hatred and we don't want you here. And that attitude is still too strong, and that's what the esprit de corps and all the training and talk about zero tolerance of sexual assault, that's where it fails, because it doesn't. Some of their men there who still have that attitude towards women, the rules aren't going to be followed.
There's an unwritten code of silence when it comes to sexual assault in the military. If this happened to me and no one knew about it, then I know it's happening to other females as well. It makes me mad to think that I let them get to me. and I left the military. I was so proud of being third-generation Air Force. I had dreamed of becoming a high-ranking officer like my father and my grandfather before him. Now those dreams will never come true.
Helen Benedict is the author of The Lonely Soldier, The Private War of Women Serving in Iraq. Anne Strangeham spoke with her. Carrie Kuhn read excerpts of Helen Benedict's interviews with Air Force Sergeant Marty Ribeiro.
I'm Lieutenant Shannon Kilcoyne, and I deployed with the 264th Engineer Group of Chippewa Falls. And as I was deployed, I was a platoon leader for a combat heavy engineer battalion. I believe that it was late summer, and we were tasked to go out and fortify one of the traffic control points. And there was a big traffic backup, as you often would see in Iraq. People would sit in their cars for hours and hours and hours. And as vehicles slowly rolled through the traffic control point, I saw one vehicle where there was a woman and two children in the back seat. And for most of my experience up to this point, I had only seen women with their faces at least half covered by some sort of veil. And this woman was initially, as they were passing, she sort of looked sideways at me. And once she realized that there was a woman out there in a uniform, her eyes lit up. I'd never seen anything like it. She was all of a sudden so enthused. She pointed me out to her children, who started waving and yelling, and they started to roll the window down. And the woman, the mother, actually pulled her veil down so I could see her entire face, gave me the biggest smile I've ever seen, and waved goodbye to me. And that was quite a moment to experience.
For to the best of our knowledge, I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, Esprit de Corps is part of our special series, Boots on the Ground, Stories from the War in Iraq, brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Brian Turner was your average American soldier fighting in Iraq. He was young, he volunteered, he missed home, he was brave. But Brian Turner had a secret. At night, while his fellow soldiers slept, he switched on his flashlight and escaped, writing poetry. He collected his Iraq War poems in a book called Here, Bullet. Anne Strangeham spoke with Turner after he got back from his tour of duty and asked him to read the title poem.
Here, Bullet. If a body is what you want, then here is bone and gristle and flesh. Here is the clavicle-snapped wish, the aorta's open valves, the leap thought makes at the synaptic gap. Here is the adrenaline rush you crave, that inexorable flight, that insane puncture into heat and blood. And I dare you to finish what you've started, because here, Bullet, here is where I complete the word you bring hissing through the air. Here is where I moan the barrel's cold esophagus, triggering my tongue's explosives for the rifling I have inside of me, each twist of the round spun deeper, because here, Bullet, here is where the world ends every time.
That is such a beautiful and harrowing poem, both at the same time. Where were you when you wrote it?
I was in Mosul. I think it was February of 2004. And I wrote it, and I put it in a Ziploc bag, and I put it in my breast pocket and carried it there the remainder of the tour that we were there for about another 7 or 8 months or so.
Wow.
So,
would you read us another poem? I mean, maybe there's one that you like especially.
I always like to read Eulogy. It's important to me. And there's a story I always say with this because I think it's important, and that is when my unit came back from Iraq, our brigade was arrayed out on a parade field. And it was a sunny day, and there were friends and family in the bleachers, reporters, banners, and the colonel came up to give a speech. And he gave a very good speech, and at one point he asked for a moment of silence while he read the names of those who didn't come back with us. As he read the list, I realized that he didn't say the name of a soldier in my platoon, Private Bruce Miller, Private First Class Bruce Miller. and who was in the second squad Bravo team. He was a machine gunner. And I feel to this day that his name wasn't in that list because he didn't die what was considered a soldier's death. In some small way, I hope this poem rectifies that. Eulogy. It happens on a Monday at 11:20 a.m. as tower guards eat sandwiches and seagulls drift by on the Tigris River. Prisoners tilt their heads to the west, though burlap sacks and duct tape blind them. The sound reverberates down concertina coils the way piano wire thrums when given slack. And it happens like this, on a blue day of sun, when Private Miller pulls the trigger to take brass and fire into his mouth. The sound lifts the birds up off the water. A mongoose pauses under the orange trees. And nothing can stop it now, no matter what blur of motion surrounds him, no matter what voices crackle over the radio in static confusion, because if only for this moment the earth is stilled, and Private Miller has found what low hush there is down in the eucalyptus shade there by the river.
Mm. That's beautiful. The persona that comes through in your poems is really interesting because there is that toughness and the anger and the practicality of a soldier who's there to do a job. And then there's also at times such tenderness. Mm-hmm. It's almost painful realizing that those two could be present together for you. I wanted to ask you about a couple of different poems. There's one called What Every Soldier Should Know. Maybe you'd read that one for us.
Sure. This poem starts with a quote from Rousseau, which says, "To yield to force is an act of necessity, not of will. It is at best an act of prudence. What every soldier should know. If you hear gunfire on a Thursday afternoon, it could be for a wedding or could be for you. Always enter home with your right foot. The left is for cemeteries and unclean places. Ogif tara armik is rarely useful. It means stop or I'll shoot. Sabah akhir is effective. It means good morning. Inshallah means Allah be willing. Listen well when it is spoken. You will hear the RPG coming for you. Not so the roadside bomb. There are bombs under the overpasses, in trash piles, in bricks, in cars. There are shopping carts with clothes soaked in foo gas, a sticky gel of homemade napalm. Parachute bombs and artillery shells sewn into the carcasses of dead farm animals. Graffiti sprayed under the overpasses, I will kill you, American. Men wearing vests rigged with explosives walk up, raise their arms, and say, Inshallah. There are men who earn $80 to attack you, $5,000 to kill. Small children who will play with you, old men with their talk, women who offer chai, and any one of them may dance over your body tomorrow.
So that really conveys such a strong sense of separation from the people of Iraq, the people who may be at any moment trying to kill you. And on the facing page, there's another poem, the Al-Harishma Weapons Market, with this vignette of a guy who's running a small weapons market, putting his four-year-old to bed. And it's written with such tenderness. So I wanted to ask you how those things can be there together.
You know, as you're driving through the streets and you see different people's faces, you can see just as you can here in America. If you walk down the city sidewalk in Chicago or New York or, you know, some small town here in Fresno, Madera or something, where I come from, you see people's faces and you see happy people and sad people. And I knew that everyday people on the street in Iraq are struggling just to live their lives, to love the people that they care about, and to find a way to regain the life that they might have once had.
Mm-hmm. This seems like sort of an odd question, but you're back now and you've had one of the most intense experiences of your life and you've written some beautiful and desolate poetry. Is there any way in which you miss the war?
I miss Bosch and Fiorillo and Joukowsky and Zavala and even Hathaway. You know, there's the people that I worked with. I miss them, and Knight and Lou. You know, the squad that I was in. And I do miss some of the beauty and the things I saw while I was over there and learning about a place. But every day I was there, I was hoping I could go home.
Yeah, there are a number of poems in which you kind of convey that, but I'm thinking especially about the one near the end as you're leaving, Night in Blue.
Oh, yes.
Would you read that one for us?
Sure. Night in Blue. At 7,000 feet and looking back, running lights blacked out under the wings and America waiting, a year of my life disappears at midnight. The sky, a deep viridian. The house lights below, small as match heads burned down to embers. Has this year made me a better lover? Will I understand something of hardship, of loss? Will a lover sense this in my kiss or touch? What do I know of redemption or sacrifice? What will I have to say of the dead, that it was worth it, that any of it made sense? I have no words to speak of war. I never dug the graves in Tal Afar. I never held a mother crying in Ramadi. I never lifted my friend's body when they carried him home. I have only the shadows under the leaves to take with me, the quiet of the desert, the low fog of Balad, orange groves with ice forming on the rinds of fruit. I have a woman crying in my ear late at night when the stars go dim, moonlight and sand as a resonance of the dust of bones, and nothing more.
Brian Turner served as an infantry team leader with the 3rd Striker Brigade combat unit in Iraq. His book of poetry is called Here, Bullet. Anne Strainchamp spoke with him. For To the Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Jim Fleming. This hour is called Esprit de Corps. It's part of our special series, Boots on the Ground, Stories from the War in Iraq, brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio. This series was produced by Charles Monroe Kane, with the help of Veronica Rickert, Anne Strainchamps, Doug Gordon, Mary Lou Finnegan, Claire Radomski, and Madeline Mayen. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. Original theme music for Boots on the Ground, Stories from the War in Iraq, was written by Steve Mullen at Walk West Productions. For more information on the series, please go to our website at ttbook.org/bootsontheground.
PRI, Public Radio International.